Jonah 4. One of the top five chapters of Jonah. Jonah was furious. He lost his temper. He yelled at God. God, I knew it. When I was back home, I knew this was going to happen. That's why I ran off to Tarshish. I knew you were sheer grace and mercy, not easily angered, rich in love, and ready at the drop of a hat to turn your plans of punishment into a program of forgiveness. So God, if you won't kill them, kill me. I'm better off dead. God said, what do you have to be angry about? But Jonah just left. He went out of the city to the east and sat down in a sulk. He put together a makeshift shelter of leafy branches and sat there in the shade to see what would happen to the city. God arranged for a broadleaf tree to spring up. It grew over Jonah to cool him off and get him out of his angry sulk. Jonah was pleased and enjoyed the shade. Life was looking up. But then God sent a worm. By dawn of the next day, the worm had bored into the shade tree and it withered away. The sun came up and God sent a hot, blistering wind from the east. The sun beat down on Jonah's head and he started to faint. He prayed to die. I'm better off dead. Then God said to Jonah, what right do you have to get angry about this shade tree? Jonah said, plenty of right. It made me angry enough to die. God said, what's this? How is it that you can change your feelings from pleasure to anger overnight about a mere shade tree that you did nothing to get? You neither planted nor watered it. It grew up one night and died the next night. So why can't I likewise change what I feel about Nineveh from anger to pleasure, this big city of more than 120,000 childlike people who don't yet know right from wrong, to say nothing of all the innocent animals? This is the word of the Lord.
Oh man, if I would have known that we were going to read the message, I would have named this sermon The Sulk of Jonah. I mean, for real. I just want to say kind of to straight off, I'm sure you all had lively discussions like we did, that everything doesn't happen for a reason, or at least not the way that phrase is often used as a trite platitude. And all kinds of things happen in life. Even at the best of times, it's messy, exhausting, confusing, dirty. I can't tell you how many hours I spent cleaning my house yesterday. Exhausting, and most of us in the day on E. And an unprecedented number of us struggle just to get up in the morning and go to work and make new friends. And depression is certainly everywhere, but so is Netflix. In a kind of infamous interview in like 2015, someone asked Netflix about these new platforms that were coming and whether or not they were worried. And Netflix says, you know, no, we're not worried about these other platforms. We've done our research. And our research indicates that the greatest competitor to Netflix is sleep. So there's that. There are more things than ever to choose from, and choice fatigue is very real. Ask anyone who is selecting 7 out of 27 middle school lottery choices this week and putting them in ranked order. Movies stick to genres. Horror, comedy, satire, poetry, drama. Life does not. Life is messy and choices are hard and we don't know why things happen often. But they just keep happening. I remember right after COVID started, the Arnetts had this letter board that they had in their house that they put their kids' quotes on. And I can't remember the exact one. Do you know it? Okay, tell me exactly because I had like a guess. Oh, why do you keep... See, I thought it was like, why do viruses always come after tornadoes? I thought it was like something. Oh, okay. It's like the unanswerable questions. Why do viruses always come after tornadoes? Who knows? A while back, I started reading the book, The Midnight Library. Anyone read The Midnight Library? Okay, one. I knew you had read it. I don't know if anyone else had. Well, I hated it. It's about this girl. It's about this girl whose life has just gone down and downhill and downhill, and she chooses to commit suicide. And that's like chapter one, right? When she does commit suicide, she goes to this place called the Midnight Library, where she discovers that her life actually doesn't have to go how it went, but that she has this second chance in this Midnight Library where sort of like the worlds between life and death have met. And she can actually go back through opening these different books, which are all stories of her life had she made different choices, to find this key moment where she might change something about her life that might make her life better. If she can find a version of her life in the Midnight Library that she wants to live, then she can just go on living in that version of her life. The trick is finding the moment that she wants to change. So is it the relationship that she regrets letting go of? Maybe she should have married that guy. Is it the career path that she didn't fight hard enough for? Is it the friendship that opens doors to live in a foreign country that she should have jumped at? Because I hated this book because in so many stupid ways, her life could have played out worse than it did. The boyfriend was abusive, and she forgot about the warning signs that made her break up with him the first time around. The career in Antarctica resulted in a tragic accident involving a polar bear. It was all very depressing, like watching the news or reflecting too much about what's going on in the world. It's like having choices that's supposed to make us free has kind of made us miserable. Humans took freedom, just think about it. Humans took freedom of choice and creation and created capitalism, created semi-automatic assault weapons, created social media. I'm not saying everything is bad, although assault weapons, I will say, is all bad. And with our choices, we've created all of these things, including bought into all of these things like addictions that leave us half dead, half asleep, half focused, and half alive. Every invention seems to get twisted up into evil ends at some point. And we jump on board initially maybe because it's fun or it's distracting or it's entertaining or the research hasn't yet come out yet about it. Chalk many things up to that one. And we've just gone down, 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 down. Exactly like Jonah does. Down to Joppa. Down to the recesses of the ship, laying down to go to sleep. He goes down into a deep sleep. And finally, when at his lowest, he is thrown overboard, he goes down into the watery depths and gets swallowed by a fish and goes down into that fish's belly, where he says in his psalm, he is in the womb of Sheol. Sheol is this place of the dead, this underworld. He is in the womb of Sheol. God says, arise, and Jonah goes down. And that is just humans for you. That's like the thing we do. And you can't miss it in the Hebrew here. Jonah is the son of Amati. Amati is the Hebrew word for faithfulness. It's like Jonah, son of faithfulness, chooses unfaithfulness. And once he is set out in this trajectory, it is very hard to turn around. But Jonah is kind of a funny book. Whereas Jonah should obey and doesn't, the people in Jonah who shouldn't obey God, the Gentiles, the Ninevites, and the sailors, do. And not just the other people, But all of creation actually obeys God in this story. So the wind, the waves, the fish, the storm, the sun, the vine, all of these God commands and they obey. Nature and Nineveh and pretty much every part of Jonah seems to happen for a reason. It's almost like it's a made-up story. I mean, knowing what God sent, being able to access the information behind the scenes of God's intention is sort of unique, right? How does the narrator know what everyone's intentions are in the story? Scholars have suggested that Jonah could be many genres: an allegory or a didactic story, a fable, a fairy tale, folklore, a historical account, legend, midrash, myth, novella, parable, parody, prophetic tale, saga, satire, sermon, short story, or tragedy. One of those. Jonah resists being categorized. And not only is it hard to find what Jonah's genre is, the theology in the tale is extremely dissonant. There are themes of sovereignty and freedom. There are themes of creation and retribution and vindictiveness and violence and repentance and mercy and pity. One isn't sure how to take the things that occur in Jonah. For one thing, you think the fish is miraculously saving Jonah, but it turns out Jonah made the fish sick after all. So depending on where you're at in the story, this is a good thing or this is a bad thing. Jonah's theology resists this categorization, and yet the story forms this cohesive storyline. And it makes you wonder, what are we supposed to get from this story? What is the point of this story? And particularly because it's hard to date Jonah, somewhere maybe in 5 centuries. That's the best guess, somewhere among 5 centuries. And because we have no idea who wrote Jonah, and also because we don't know what their intentions are, it's kind of hard to say. What is the purpose of this story? Which is what I was wondering when I was reading The Midnight Library. What am I supposed to get from this story, from this collection of mishaps and mistakes? What's the point of this? But then I saw it. And it's so goofy. The part in Jonah where the cows get dressed. You know what I'm talking about. The king of Nineveh is like, no one eat or drink. Everyone put on sackcloth. Oh yeah, and all the cattle and herds don't eat or drink and put on sackcloth. If you don't believe me, go back and read that chapter. I think it's chapter 3. The king of Nineveh demands the animals put on sackcloth. Well, that's got to be pretty funny. I'm trying to picture the film version of this, where the cows get dressed. The king of Nineveh calls for this communal fast, and in the storytelling of Jonah, and this is not the only part, but this is just the one part I wanted to pull out, animals and nature have equal status to people in the ways that they can pray, worship, repent, obey, and listen to God. It's very unique, this situation, right? Jonah has these very strong creation vibes. And the thing about creation in the story of Jonah is that it always seems to have no problem obeying God, or humans for that matter. I have a theory that creation, now I'm excluding humans from this, so sorry for the, we were talking about philosophically how that's problematic in our group, but I have a theory that creation, excluding humans, is like the Enneagram 9 of theology. Creation just wants to get along with God, get along with each other, get along with humans, whatever they're told to do, we're just going to get along with it. Put on sackcloth. Okay, here it is. They don't want to rock the boat unless they're the wind that God sends to rock the boat. And in that case, they're just doing what they're supposed to. They're doing what they're designed to do. We're just going to get along. Whereas humans are given this choice, and the choice often makes them miserable because whereas nature goes with the flow, humans often choose not to. I love this Sirach passage we read today, and it reminds me a lot of Psalm 1, which goes, "Blessed is the one who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly, or stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but their delight is in the law of the Lord. And on that law they meditate day and night. They are like a tree planted by a stream of water that yields fruit in season. Everything they do prospers. The ungodly are not so. They're like the chaff the wind drives away. Therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish." Sirach 15 through 17 and Psalm 1 are so much about nature following God by its very nature. Humans have to choose that path, this path of goodness, the path nature chooses without a choice. But even if humans choose to disobey God like Jonah does, God can respond. This poetry in Sirach is so beautiful. Sirach compares humans to the sun and then says, "What is brighter than the sun? And yet it can be eclipsed." In Jonah, that eclipse is God acting, God responding to Jonah's bad choices through nature's obedient ones. By the end of Jonah, there's this great sigh. What does the message say? This great sulk, this great sulk. Jonah knows his choices have led him here. And in so many ways, he has already given up on himself, but God hasn't given up on him. God has sustained his life. The girl in the midnight library got exhausted of trying all these different options and never finding the right one that fixed her broken life. And she almost gave up. And Jonah almost gave up too. And maybe he did. We don't really know. The book ends with God's question. But both stories climax with the same realization that the human seemingly bad choices, the ones that caused all their suffering, when it came down to it, that wasn't the problem. It was their perspective that was the problem all along. The girl realized that she had made all the right decisions in her original life. Spoiler alert. That she wouldn't change anything. No decisions. But because people didn't respond the way she wanted them to, she had kind of fallen on hard times. And in a way, it's kind of like that movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where she finally realizes that the people who love her, that there are people who love her and count on her, there are people for whom literally still wouldn't be alive if she had made different choices. And it totally changes her perspective by the end of the book. This is one of those books you hate all the way through until the very end. God asked Jonah the same question multiple times at the end of the book. Is it good? Is it right? Is it appropriate that you are angry? The word it uses is tov. Is it good that you are angry? Is it tov that you are angry? Tov is a real important word. In the Genesis account of creation, God creates on day one and says, it is tov. God creates on day two and says, it is tov. Days 3, 4, 5, 6, tov, 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 tov. Day 7, after the creation of the Sabbath, God looks at all that he has created and says, it is very tov, very good. And he asked Jonah, is it tov? Is it good? Is it right? Is this the intended purpose of this? For you to be angry? Is it appropriate for you to be angry? Jonah's negative outlook, his perspective, is the sun that God is trying to eclipse. God is trying to help Jonah see that regardless of his past choices, his real choice in the moment is not what he will do, but rather how he will see what has happened. In other words, what story will Jonah tell about what has happened to him? What would the genre of Jonah's story be if he told it? If Jonah wrote a journal about these events, what would his journal say? Will it say, I am still angry enough to die? Will it say, I watch Netflix until I fall asleep every night now because I don't want to think about my life anymore? Will it say, I worry every day that I won't have a vine to shade my head? Everything happens. Many things not for a reason. But I wonder if Jonah's perspective changed on what had happened. I wonder if he did write something later. After it was all over, you know, looking back on it all, I wonder if he might have said, it seems like everything that happened was important for some reason. That nothing was wasted. That even when I went down, 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 God was with me. My sour attitude, my sighing and complaining and worrying about my own life, they weren't good. I see that now. Life is bigger than my limited experience. And all of nature testifies to God's ways. The natural world doesn't have a choice, but I do. And I've tried my own way, and now I want to try to go along with God's way. I want to live up to my name, Jonah, son of Amati, and become Jonah, son of faithfulness once again. I want to be free to be what God has called me to be. I want to be like a tree planted by a stream of water, yielding fruit in season, whose leaves don't wither, and whatever I do prosper. God, make all that I do prosper in the greater, grander picture of this world. If you were a tree, okay, you guys want to close your eyes? Close your eyes, please. It'll help us. If you were a tree planted by a stream of water, If you were in sync with God's ways in the world, if you were free to be exactly what God created you to be, what kind of tree would you be? What would your leaves look like? What would it feel like to suck up that cool water from your roots? In capitalism, we're often concerned about the fruit. And the fruit matters. What would the fruit be? But it all matters, doesn't it? Where you're planted, what your purpose is, what God made you to do. Are there any ways that you're trying to uproot yourself because maybe you should have been planted somewhere else? Are you afraid of the storms that will come and harm you next to this stream? Is there anything that would change your perspective, that would make you happy, even in the midst of perhaps suffering or loss or just the season of winter, that a changed perspective would make all the difference in the world? Okay, you can slowly open your eyes and find your little handout here. And will you join with me as we close and get ready for the kids to come back in praying together this, the covenant prayer that was written by John Wesley? So pray this with me, meaning aloud with me, not just in your hearts. Let's pray. I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Place me with whom you will. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be put to work for you or set aside for you, praised for you or criticized for you. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely and fully surrender all things to your glory and service. And now, O wonderful and holy God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer, you are mine and I am yours. So be it. And the covenant which I have made on earth, let it also be made in heaven.